From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. And we are covering a movie this week that I think we're actually kind of stunned we haven't covered before, because it seems to be in our wheelhouse. But with the news of Bruce Willis retiring from acting because of some sad medical reasons, we decided what the hell, we'll just do a Bruce movie this week, and we'll do one that a lot of people love to hate. So you know, maybe give it a little love and maybe a little more hate this week. But with me this week is Stu, and there you go, Stu. Hunter is not available this week. He's working with his students, and I think they got a film festival coming up or something like that. But anyway, Stu, I guess we got to do the obligatory whip out our junk here. You want to go for it?
Yep. And I just want to inform new viewers to us on YouTube who will sit through the first 15 minutes going, what are these guys showing things that they bought? We do a segment at the start called Whip Out Your Junk, which it's just what purchases were made, et cetera, et cetera. It's not showing off. It's just showing you what's out there and some things that may have gotten through the cracks that you don't know are out there. That's all it is. So just bear with us. It should be should be about 10 minutes, this one. And then after that, we'll be straight into the review of Hudson Hawk.
Right.
So I will start off. I've got quite a few, but I will whip through them real quick.
Okay.
And I need to, remove my background for that before I forget, make a fool of myself. Background, none. Okay. So now I'll be able to show you. So first up, we've got these are all a dollar each at a thrift store, I should say. Area 7, Say to My Face, local band here from Melbourne, who I used to go see back in the late 90s. Ska band, good band, really enjoy them. And that's a difficult one to find these days, because that's from 2001, so it's not easy to find, because it was only independently released.
Was Ska really big in Melbourne?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. You had a real big following. And the band that really helped that was this one. This one's a good album, this. Bangig Mafia by the Voodoo Glow Skulls.
Oh yeah, those guys. I've seen them live.
They were huge here.
Yeah. They play like one small theater here and draw a decent crowd, but it was a fun show.
Yeah, that's a great album, that one. some other titles I picked up for a buck were Me First and the Gimme Gimmies, Have a Ball. Not bad. Fat Mike's side band. They take cover songs and punk them up. Me First and the Gimme Gimmies, Take a Break. Another good one. This one I picked up for a buck as well. And it's not so great. It's all right. The singer's really freaking annoying. Leg Wagons, Hoss. What else have I got?
It's like 90s Punk-a-rama.
It's so hard to find. It was, yeah. The thrift store in the CD section, someone just must have offloaded all their 90s pop punk stuff. I'm like, well, for a buck each, I'll pick them up. I mean, granted, the covers are in really good shape. The discs, yeah. I mean, they play.
Right.
They play through, which is...
They're on some skaters.
If you're looking for
them,
for Chris Pinkoli, not going to happen. Oh yeah, they were on some skater's floor in the end.
Right, right.
Who thought, nah, I don't want these. But and obviously couldn't sell them on Discogs because no one's going to take them in the state they were in disc wise. Right. But hey, they played, and I don't give a shit. If I ever get a JFJ Easy Pro machine, which I want to, then I'll fix them up and fly that. But whatever. This is one that I've been looking for ages, but it's so hard to find. Had to get it from a Discog seller in the UK, sent to Nesbitt's house, And then there's the on send it to me. Eve's Plum, Envy. Yeah, from 94, I think it is.
I saw them live.
Colin Fitzpatrick.
Yeah.
You saw him live? Oh, wow.
I saw him open for...
Later to become Vitamin C.
They opened for, I believe, My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult. I saw them open for them. And it was supposed to be Lords, but Tracy Lords didn't hit the stage. It was like 40 minutes of just, you know, an empty stage and loud techno music because she chickened out or something. I don't know if it happened. I don't know how it would have sounded. Well,
there was a bummer for the night.
Yeah, and then, it was Eve's Plum, and then at 40 minutes of nothing, thanks to Tracy Lords no showing, or not taking the stage, even though the roadie was coming out going, are you ready for Tracy? And she never came out. And then My Life is Thrill Kill Cult for like 90 minutes, which was all right. You know, I wasn't really into him. I just went to go to a show. And Eve's Plum, I thought, kind of the highlight. You know?
No, that's pretty cool. You get to see them there in a day. This one's probably going to elicit some laughter or an eye roll or both, but I don't give a shit. I've been listening to this band, and I found this on Amazon for $7.07. Greatest hits of Dr. Hook. I love me some Dr. Hook.
They're
cool ass band.
There's something to say for some fun old boomer music, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. as predicted, the new Ghost album, Impera.
I still haven't listened to these guys.
Get off your ass, man. I think you'll actually like them.
I probably will. They actually sound like they're up my alley, but I just,
if you listen to the two first albums, they're more like darker, hard rock, heavy rock. It may not be your cup of tea. The more poppy phase they're going through now in the last sort of 5 years or so is way better. More up your alley, I dare say. Last up, I got two books. This is a book that Nesbitt sent me, which is very, very, very cool, called Shock Horror. And out of print, but what it is a book full of video nasty posters. look, there's one for Fight for Your Life.
Oh, yeah.
Connotation that is to the MMC.
Don't know if I've seen that one.
Yeah, this goes for a goddamn fortune. I told Anthony, I said, you realize what it goes? He goes, I don't care. Because I'd rather go to a house where someone's going to appreciate it, which, thanks, Nez, this book rules. and he's got some more coming towards me, some other ones like that, but for adult films, which I can't wait to get. And I have one more book, which I should have grabbed earlier. That was too freaking stupid too. And this is one called The Devil Made Me Do It, a memoir by Georgina Spelvin.
Uh-oh.
Famous for, as John's reaction is there, The Devil and Miss Jones.
Yeah, and, I brought it up before, but I think I saw her at a Chiller Con. I think the first Chiller Con I went to, she had an autograph table.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was just sort of looking at books on Amazon, and this one came in my recommended, and it was only $8.92 with a 1 day delivery. I thought, I'll buy it. Why not?
Yeah. And she'll say her worst experience was Police Academy.
I don't know. I've not read it yet, but I think that's one that, they've got to notice. She was certainly well known for all the other reasons. Back in the 70s, but
Devil and Miss Jones.
Yeah. Oh, and there was some two or three DVDs Nez sent me, which Off Yonder, which I won't bother going to. He gave me a Italian version of a film called Dollars with, is it Warren Beatty, I think, and Goldie Hawn?
Yeah, that's
they're called Dollares. So I don't know. And there was a couple of other titles Nez threw in there.
Oh, he probably should have said, he should have said that to me, because Eric and I have been kicking around a goofy idea of starting a Beatty cast and reviewing Warren Beatty movies because nobody else is going to do it. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I just also question this mystique of Warren Beatty, which we don't get at all. So it's very hard to figure out.
Yeah, well, we spoke about that on the Parallax View episode, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah. And he's... even Dick Tracy, I think we got into that a bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's right.
So it's an ongoing mystery. So we were thinking, hey, you know, people who've never seen Al Pacino movies are doing something like Pacino Cast. Maybe we should do Beatty Cast to try to, because he has a very small filmography for the guy to have the studio power he has.
Does he? You really?
Yeah. I mean, it's not huge. It's not as big as you'd think.
Mm.
And I think also because he was doing those personal productions that took like years of, you know, like Reds and Dick Tracy. And, you know, that was in the works for like 10 years. And Ishtar, I think, took a while to make. And, you know, everything else. This last one, I think, was in development for decades.
What was his last one?
It was the one where he played Howard Hughes. I can't remember the title because it has a weird, like nondescript title. I thought the movie was okay though.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fine. It wasn't like worthless, like most what's in the theaters these days. It wasn't Morbius, which it wasn't disposable.
Oh, my son, my 15-year-old son, went and saw it on Saturday, and I said, "So how was it?" He goes, "Oh, it was all right."
Yeah, that's. I saw it Friday. It was just okay. But it's funny that something costs that much money to make. It was probably, it has tons of reshoots. It's obvious. They've been tinkering with it because it's been on the shelf for 2 years. But it's just okay. It's like, is it really worth the money to try to perfect something that's kind of mediocre and just rainy afternoon movie in the first place? Strange attitude.
Hollywood's on an absolute free fall at the moment.
Snow's diving. I don't even think there'll be a movie business like we know it. In 2 years, maybe three.
Well, Will Smith didn't help.
No, not at all.
Dickhead. Not a dickhead.
I kind of think that whole thing was fake, but you know, what do I know? I don't know if I really care if it was fake or real.
Okay, if it was fake, why would you do it even? What's
my thinking? Okay, my thinking is it was fake because they needed somebody to talk about the Oscars because the ratings have dwindled to nothing. Lately, I mean, they probably barely match the average episode of The Good Doctor on American television. So it's like they needed something to get people talking. And I noticed the ratings shot up. They were up this year. And I'll bet there was a switchover of TVs, if they still do Nielsen's, when that story hit Twitter. So everybody tuned into the Oscars all of a sudden. Oh, what a fight happened? You know, it's a publicity stunt to me. Because I think security is so tight at those events. You can't just walk up on stage if you're not called or whatever. You know, they have to be prepared for an actor to walk up, you know, unprovoked or provoked to walk up on stage and attack the host. There's no way you could tell me they don't have security set up for that sort of event.
If that was staged as the biggest fail of all time, it's just, it got attention for all the wrong reasons.
Right.
Okay, but then if it was staged, why did he resign from the Academy, Will Smith, or has he?
He could go back and apply next year, and he's back in. If he really cares, if it backfires on his career, well then, okay, he's made all his major studio films. He can just go make whatever the hell he wants for indie cinema, kind of like maybe a little more respectable than what Bruce Willis has been doing the last few years. But I think that's a sad exploitation of a beloved actor. You know, best way to put it, I guess. So anything else to whip out?
That is it.
All right. I'll go through mine really quick. Make sure I haven't done this with a background yet, but I may have to remove it. Okay, let's see here. I don't know. I'll just keep it. What I have, can we see this? Oh, we'll see if I can get it here. There we go. Blackie the Pirate. Which of course is blue with Bud Spencer and Terrence Hill. This is actually a Finnish Blu-ray, which you can barely see. It's I bought it off eBay. There's a dealer over in Europe selling the Finnish Blu-rays, which have the English dub and no forced subtitles like the German Blu-rays of the Terrence Hill Bud Spencer movies. So I've ordered a few of those. That's the first one to come in. Well, actually, I bought Troublemakers or The Fight Before Christmas from the same dealer last year, and that looked great. Good looking Blu-ray, and he had more up for sale. And I've never seen a good copy of Blackie the Pirate. Don't even believe I've watched the whole film. And so finally, I was able to see it for real this time, or, you know, a pleasant view. And also, Ultra 7X, this just came out today from Mill Creek. It's, I believe, a 13-episode Ultra 7 series where, you know, more tokusatsu, Ultraman action, and a more recent show. I believe shot on digital video, but I'll look forward to seeing that. I've never seen it before.
Right.
And that's it.
I've never seen an Ultraman, I think. Did we do an Ultraman movie? I know I wasn't for it. I wasn't on the episode. No,
we did Inframan, which was kind of a Hong Kong.
Inframan.
Yeah, it's a Hong Kong knockoff of those Japanese tokusatsu shows, but instead they made a violent Shaw Brothers superhero film. But Ultraman itself is a huge franchise in Japan. And, Mill Creek has done pretty well with these domestic releases, mostly subtitled of Ultraman, because they put out a new Ultra show seems like every year, and Mill Creek has been acquiring them for home video and releasing them, and they've been pretty steady with it, and doesn't look like they're stopping anytime soon, so they must be doing all right, and they're reasonably priced, and it's fun for me to catch up on this stuff and watch it with subtitles and try to understand the crazy plot lines for a children's show. But
As long as there's no creatures coming out of the sea.
Sometimes there are. Sometimes they have a lake monster, you know.
Watch that.
Right.
Not happening.
Okay, so let's move on to our movie topic, Hudson Hawk. This was the, get up the IMDb entry so I don't get any directors wrong on this or whatever. Released in 1991. Directed by Michael Lehman, who had was coming off of Heathers, which was a huge cult hit, critical hit, if not box office. Starred Bruce Willis, was sort of his dream project.
This is what you call cashing in your chips.
Danny Aiello, Andy McDowell, Sandra Bernhard, Richard E. Grant, let's see, James Coburn. let's see, gosh, it's a huge cast.
Yeah, well, Bruce Willis was a very popular actor at the time, so you could pretty much wrangle in who he wanted.
Yeah, I would say he was probably the top star at the time because Die Hard was such a surprise hit, and excuse me, Die Hard was a huge hit, and he was kind of the hottest actor in Hollywood at the time, and so this was sort of the movie he made that was his dream project. Oh my God, David Caruso is in this. Brittany Arskew later played Leatherface in one of the thousands of Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies.
Oh, that's where I knew the name. That big guy, that big blonde guy with the missing front tooth. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, so this was Bruce Willis's personal project. It was sort of a attempt at doing a catch a thief type of caper flick with James Coburn in, and plus with a certain ringtone. There's sort of a tribute to the Flint movies from the 60s that Coburn starred in. It's got it's produced by Joel Silver, so it's very over the top of the action and stunts. You get a lot of that, but you also get a lot of weird black comedy thanks to the screenwriter Daniel Waters, who had written Heathers and did a rewrite of this. I think Steven D'Souza did the basic script with the skeletal script, I imagine, and then Daniel Waters came in and wrote all the really dark humor stuff. It seems like an ego trip for Bruce, I guess, because it was co-written. He devised the story with a friend of his who was a musician who came up with a song. I think actually wrote the song Hudson Hawk or something. And this is the only thing they ever did in writing that we've seen in credits. And it's very designed to Bruce Willis's quirks. It's got him singing because he fancied himself a singer at the time. This was, I think, right after the return of Bruno. HBO special.
I picked up for a buck years. And I thought,
oh my gosh.
Okay, I've got to try out for a buck. This is when that whole boom of, you know, let's just discard vinyl and throw it out the door for next to nothing.
Right. So you got his wink, and doesn't he wink on the cover? He's got that side view of himself.
He's got a side view.
He's like, does he sing with the Temptations or no, Pointer Sisters or something like that? It's a Respect Yourself.
Four Tops. I don't know, one of those bands, but it was not good.
It's kind of boomer soul music worship at its worst, you know, white boomer, blue-eyed soul. But I mean, Bruce was likable. People let him get away with a lot. He was doing the wine cooler ads, which I think kind of made him popular outside of Moonlighting. Moonlighting was already a very successful show.
You know, that's the thing I wanted to ask you, John. How I think Moonlighting's absolutely boring. I don't like it.
Well, this is, you have to remember what TV shows were like in the 80s in America. You have to think in terms of, you know, we didn't have those, all the British shows people talk about. We didn't watch those unless you were like somebody watching PBS, you know. Moonlighting was the first like detective show similar to Remington Steele, but it was edited like a movie. Like when Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd would have that Howard Hawks style banter back and forth, like His Girl Friday, it was fast cutting. There was like movie level photography, the way they did the editing. They would use like real music, like Miami Vice and Hunter. Those were two shows that were using the actual music and not those kind of, we've talked about it before, but they have the kind of fake cover versions in American TV shows. Like, you know, Mike Post and Pete Carpenter are singing a Huey Lewis song and you're supposed to not notice it's not really that song. You know, it's, yeah, it's
get around the legal rights of using.
Right. They don't have to pay a royalty to the performers. Yeah. They just have to pay to the songwriters and the publishing or whatever. Yeah. And, the Moonlighting would have like the real music. It would have guests like Whoopi Goldberg, who was for some reason had a hot movie career at the time. It had a unique style, but the problem was what made it unique was the perfectionist that Glenn Gordon Caron brought into the project. He was a Remington Steele writer who sold this. It's basically a ripoff of Remington Steele, but he sold it to ABC, and he was also a perfectionist. So the rumor at the time was they had constant delays with new episodes, where you saw a rerun of one episode maybe four times in a year. That's how bad they were having to resort to reruns because episodes were delayed. And apparently the tabloid stories were always, well, Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis hate each other. And that was believable. They didn't get along. But, you know, leads of TV shows never get along. The truth is, I mean, you know, it's your coworker. You got to deal with them all the time. You know, you don't have to be pals. It's not the Flintstones, you know. But then there was this one tabloid story that said Glenn Gordon Caron was the reason for the Moonlighting delays. The guy was like a perfectionist. He was doing the Stanley Kubrick thing of 30 takes until it's perfect, pissing off the actors. He was probably ginning up the tension between the two. That's the only story I read about that. Glenn Gordon Caron went on to have an unspectacular movie career. I don't think it ever launched really. And then he did more TV shows. And then I think it was last year, there was a story published saying that Glenn Gordon Caron was the most abusive TV producer to work for. And I thought back about that Moonlighting story. And I said, so he was the reason Moonlighting was always screwed up. And so Moonlighting was this, it wasn't like a massive mainstream hit like The Cosby Show or even Miami Vice, but it had that strong following with, you know, adults who liked watching an adult mystery comedy, you know. And after a couple of seasons, it took itself too seriously. They started reading all their critic reviews and believing in themselves too much, and they made it unfunny and unentertaining. There was an attempt to go back to the comedy in the last season, but it was too little too late. They'd already alienated the audience completely. But Willis, meanwhile, did Die Hard, and nobody thought that was going to be a hit. They were like, why the hell they signed this guy to do an action movie? Yeah. And that ended up being the big surprise smash hit, you know, critical and box office success.
Somebody saw something in him.
Yeah. Said. Yeah. They there was some potential there. And, but the problem was when he made Hudson Hawk, the press was already against him the year before it was released, it was in production, and there were all these stories like talking about how this is going to be a disaster. And Bruce Willis has demanded that they rotoscope his hairline. Like, cause I guess his hair was thinning, but we could all see that. And they claimed that, they were rotoscoping hair on him. And the thing is, when you see the movie, I mean, it's the same hairline you see in Moonlighting. So what the hell are they talking about? He's got his hair cut so short, it doesn't even matter. So, and I realize Bruce Willis campaigned for Republican candidates at the time. He was openly Republican. And okay. He had made some quotes, and you could still be a Republican in Hollywood back then somewhat, you know, to a certain level. But it did turn the press against you. And then he said something that unions were the reason that movie budgets had got so high. And that's when I noticed the press really went after him. But the thing was, he was right, because after he said that, and I kind of noticed a lot of Hollywood movies were being made in Mexico and Canada to avoid union costs. So he was totally right. But everybody was mad at him because he told the truth, or for whatever reason. And also, I think there was
that.
Yeah, there was also a backlash because it was Joel Silver, and I think he was getting a bit of a bad rap as the excessive producer. And, you know, there's cocaine flowing on the set. I mean, if you've seen True Romance, right? I think it's Saul Rubinek is playing at Joel Silver's stand-in in that movie when Christian Slater goes in. He's like, yeah, bring him home in a body bag as a Vietnam classic. That's, you know, Saul is basically playing Joel Silver. I think it was Saul Rubinek. I can't remember. Yeah, and okay. The memory didn't fail me that time. And so when this movie came out, the critics just thrashed it. I mean, they were ready to just go I at remember. It. Now, people who saw it opening weekend, just average folk, everybody I talked to who saw it enjoyed it. But the problem was the studio got cold feet promoting it as for what it was, which was a comedy action spoof, you know, meant to be laughed at, not taken too seriously. And they made it look like it was Die Hard Part 5. It was like, if you want action, catch the hawk and all. That's like, oh, yeah. No, it's like, this is terrible. You're going to have so many people pissed off thinking they're getting some badass Bruce Willis action movie. And they go see this thing where Danny Aiello and Bruce Willis are acting like Bing Crosby and Bob Hope in a road picture.
Yeah.
You know, and
what did you think of the pairing of Aiello and Willis in this?
I loved it. I loved Danny Aiello. And I thought they had good chemistry. They came off like old friends, and I think they were. And it came off well on screen, and I thought they made a good duo. I enjoyed the hell out of that. And self-deprecating, like Danny Aiello is making jokes about his weight and everything, and Bruce Willis is knocking him and stuff. But you know, nobody's getting too sensitive about anything. No egos are being placated. You know,
it's John. When I watched it, I just said, "This is not funny." The jokes fall flat. There's no, I don't know. I just had myself shaking my head a lot, going, "Oh man, this is just dying. You know, cuts by a thousand deaths every moment." It's just,
well, it's. I see what you mean because it's very early '90s gallows humor, which was starting to get mainstreamed a bit. And when I saw it, I thought quite a bit of it was funny. But there were jokes that fell flat. Now, watching it this time, I hadn't seen it in 20 years. Or maybe 12 years. Those jokes still fell flat. Some other jokes didn't age well because they're too dark, too, you know, too sick in a way. And yet other jokes were fine. It's like, it's just, but it's very kind of New York mean humor, New Jersey, Northeast humor in a way. It's different from, say, you watch a movie set in the South or even the Midwest or the West Coast. It's like the humor is very, very dark Northeast stuff. But and there's a lot of inside jokes, like what Willis says to Frank Stallone. Frank Stallone plays a mafia. The direction is so easy. Even your brother could figure it out or something. Like your dumb brother. So it's like there's a lot of inside gags like that. And some of it works, some of it doesn't. But I've seen the movie too many times to really judge it on whether or not the jokes work, because once you know the jokes, the, you know, those don't always work the fourth or fifth time around. I could have problems with The Naked Gun watching it now and say, oh, this gag, you know, Back to School, maybe, you know, but those jokes tend to hold up pretty well. But
Fairlane holds up, though.
Fort Fairlane always holds up. But,
And
that is because Daniel Waters, that had two of the same screenwriters, I believe. Daniel Waters has a lot of humor in Fort Fairlane, and it probably works better there with Dice Clay because his character is a real, like, we're not supposed to find him charming anyway. But Willis, we're supposed to find charming, so your Bruce Willis tolerance factor is going to be, you know, heightened for this, you know, depending on whether or not you like him. If you don't like Bruce Willis, you're going to hate this movie.
I just found every single damn scene with Sandra Bernhardt and Richard E. Grant to be unwatchable.
They're awful in the film, and HD does not help. Oh boy, Sandra Bernhardt is fierce in HD. It is hard. She's horrifying in HD. Yeah. It's like this monster. It looks like you know, like in like Aliens when the queen is like coming at. And Sigourney Weaver, that's what Sandra Bernhardt actually looks like in HD.
She's pretty... not Not my type.
Grotesque.
I'm sure I'm not her type, but still, yeah.
Yeah. No guy is her type, apparently. But Richard E. Grant is very obnoxious. He's a bit too heightened. Supposedly, like, Michael Lehman, the director of Heathers, directed this, and I think he's actually said that Bruce Willis and Joel Silver were actually directing it. He was just kind of paid to sit there. And
another George P. Cosmatos. Huh?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. And see, he was hired because there was that trend at the time, I've mentioned this before, after Batman was a big hit, 1989, the strategy with big studios was put these kind of nerdy egghead directors to direct your action film. So, and Michael Lehman was in the Tim Burton mold, and so they had him directing the film to say, oh, look, we got our own Tim Burton here directing this, so it'll do Batman numbers. They have weird strategies, those studios. I think if Rennie Harlan had directed this, it might have been a bit more competent for the pacing and stuff. But
putting that man on a pedestal, he's hopeless.
Well, yeah, now he is. He's just horrendous. But with Die Hard 2, he could work with Bruce Willis, but I don't know. Hudson Hawk, maybe comedy's not his thing. Maybe Ford Fairlane just benefited from a perfect script with the perfect lead.
Ford Fairlane was the anomaly. It was just, it shouldn't have been a hit. I mean, it wasn't a hit, but it shouldn't have had this cult following, I should say, years later like it does. Yeah. So that was just I don't know what the components were of that made it such a, still a funny film 30 years onwards.
Yes. And maybe because it was underappreciated in its time, because there was an automatic, you shouldn't like this.
God, it was maligned.
Yeah. That it was hated because everybody was out for Dice, you know. And he's even said on like different interview shows, he's like, Fox pulled the movie. They were scared. It did really well the first week. And then they pulled it. But Hudson Hawk didn't do well. It had replaced Howard the Duck as the flop. You know, if you said, or you want another Howard the Duck, you know, it's going to bomb like Howard the Duck. Then it became, do you want another Hudson Hawk? Do you want this to bomb like Hudson Hawk? It was just like.
The thing to save Hudson Hawk was Cutthroat Island a few years later.
Yeah, yeah. Cutthroat Island then became the defining bomb. And but Hudson Hawk, I think, built an audience on home video and cable TV airings. And Bruce Willis said in an interview some, like 18 years ago, he did for Ain't It Cool News. Remember when they had that brief time where Stallone did a Q&A with the fans on Ain't It Cool News? Bruce Willis did one at Stallone's encouragement. And they asked him about Hudson Hawk, and he says, I am pleased to say, he goes, that Hudson Hawk has turned a profit. It is no longer a bomb because of the cable TV and home video sales. So he said, it finally made its money. And he said something on Charlie Rose back then where he said, I don't think any movie ever really fails. He says, I think people eventually see eventually see the movie. They'll see it on TV. They may not go see it in the theater, but they're going to see it on television. They're going to dig it then. I think he was talking about the way Hudson Hawk and maybe some of his other movies had like stronger followings on home video or TV, which is something we act like movies, like the theaters are the end all be all, but they really aren't.
No.
It's like, no. It doesn't mean anything. It's like stuff kind of builds really on home video and television. That's kind
theaters
of where
theaters is the first run for those who want to see the film after that.
Right.
It's all about home video after that. Cause home video, once it's out, it's out. It'll have multiple releases over the years, DVD, VHS,
streaming,
right?
Yeah.
Whether this gets a 4K, I don't know. I don't think so.
Plus TV airings all around the world to different TV networks in different countries. I mean, that's where the profit comes in. That's where the real money is made, I think. And so, you know, it made its money. I don't think it was, we were going to get a Hudson Hawk sequel if it had been a smash hit anyway. The concept doesn't really lend itself to that. But, looking at it now, I still enjoy some parts of it. James Coburn was kind of an interesting casting choice and made the nod to the Flint movies a bit more obvious.
I thought it was a poor choice.
Really? Playing the old CIA guy?
I'm just not much of a, not much of a James Coburn fan, to be honest with you. He's never done anything I don't think I own a film of his at all.
You may not.
Not one that's primarily fought with him as the main lead, no.
Right. So you don't have The Great Escape, right? Don't have Magnificent Seven.
Well, I do, but that's sort of a cavalcade
ensemble. Yeah. Don't have the Flint movies. I don't own them either because they weren't that good. You know, he was cooler than the movies. He was one of those actors that he was an interesting presence, but he was usually in pretty mediocre movies or movies that hadn't really been, you know, weren't finished correctly or what have you.
Mm.
Like that Sam Peckinpah movie he did, Pat Garrett, Billy the Kid, I don't like. And he doesn't save it. And he can't because it's not there. So he was, but I'm sure he did movies like that. Just, he did it for the paycheck. I don't think I've seen a truly satisfying, great James Coburn movie. Maybe The President's Analyst is the closest I've seen to that.
That's the only other one I just thought of, but Anthony sent me a year or two back, The President's Analyst, which I've got on the shelf, but I've not seen it. But
it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very 60s. It's really very 60s, but it's a good movie.
It's funny, actually, as well, because Anthony sent it to me from England to Australia, but the copy he's got an Australian release.
Well, at least the music should be accurate then.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think there's a Barry Maguire song on there that is removed from different prints, you know, for the royalty reason.
Oh, now it's on Blu-ray here now. It got one.
And they may have cleared all the music, but I know home video versions were screwed up for a while because of the music clearance.
Yeah. Speaking of music, I didn't like many things about this film, but I did like that song by Dr. John at the end, in the end credits.
The Hudson Hawk theme? Or the?
Yeah. I thought it was great. Good choice of a singer for that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that or Dr. Hook would have been good.
Can't go wrong with Dr. John, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Too bad we don't have Hunter here to talk about the scene of the Pope watching Mr. Ed.
I know. Yeah.
Missed opportunity. This was actually the Catholic publication at the time actually said this is a bad movie because it made fun of the Pope or something. And don't see it. I don't think it was the League of Decency, but it's just
Until the Pope Must Die came out a year or two later.
Yeah, then they didn't care anymore. And then they changed
the forgot all about Hudson Hawk. It was like, yeah.
In America, that was actually called The Pope Must Diet.
Yeah, they had to change the title, but it was actually released here as The Pope Must Die.
I thought, yeah.
What was it? Cool title.
Have you seen the movie?
Yeah, but then it came The Pope Must Diet, which, yeah.
Have you seen it?
I did on VHS.
Any good?
Once,
yeah, okay. Yeah.
You know, it's called The Pope Must Die. That's it.
Right.
Yeah. Not much. If you want to talk about The Pope, the best thing I've ever heard about The Pope, and I'm not saying that I want this to happen, but back in 1988, I was in England with my father and brother, and we went to see my brother and I went to see Exodus at the London Astoria, I was, and I bumped into Dan Luca from Nuclear Assault and Anthrax and SOD there, and he was at the bar, and I said, and I was 16, mind you, and I said, oh man, Dan Luca, blah, 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 I said, can I have a sip of your beer? He had a pint glass. He goes, yeah, sure, man, and I just grabbed the fucking beer, and went, sculpting down, he's just sitting there laughing, watching his kid drink this beer. And I said, oh, man, can you write me something with your singer? He goes, yeah, sure. So I grabbed the barman to give me some paper, and he wrote, Hang the Pope, Dan Luca, down the bottom. Because Hang the Pope was a Nuclear Assault song. So, yeah. So of all things related to the Pope, that's the coolest. But like I said, not advocating the action to be, enforced upon the actual Pope.
Right. But you don't want a Godfather 3 situation.
Basically. No.
but the movie itself, it's like I enjoy it. I would rather watch it over again than Die Hard, simply because Die Hard is one of those structural films you really have to pay attention to everything, and you have to sit down and watch it solidly. Hudson Hawk, you just run his background noise and you could look up and see a fun scene, kind of like a Roger Moore James Bond movie. Like, they're not really perfect, but you can always, there's always something to look at on them. And so I never hated the film. I always kind of enjoyed it and always had a copy on my shelf. And, you know, I've never disliked the movie in any way. I think I even have the Varese Saraband soundtrack CD somewhere on my shelf.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. which I think is rare now. So,
yeah, they usually didn't last those very long, those soundtracks. They would come out, then they would disappear. I know I've got, from that label, I've got Halloween 1, Halloween 2, Halloween 3. And I've got, I think, The Desperate Hours, the Mickey Rourke film.
Right.
That.
I think they're the only CDs that are very collectible after a certain point.
Yeah.
Because they never come back in print. I don't think they ever do. I keep hoping they'll release the soundtrack for the Code of Silence, the Chuck Norris movie. Because I love the soundtrack to that, but it's never had a CD release. Just one vinyl album release. And I may have to break down and just get the damn vinyl record off eBay next time it's available. And
soundtracks, it's funny you mention that. Soundtracks tend to be the ones where a subsequent CD release years later doesn't happen. When you mentioned about Code of Silence, it reminded me of Night Shift, the Ron Howard film. It's only ever had a vinyl release. I mean, I've got it.
Right.
But I know there's a lot of people out there screaming for a CD release, and there's probably a a Putin mafia pressing plant that's got it on CD somewhere, but it ain't officially.
Yeah, I think all my Suzy Quattro CDs came from a Russian pressing plant. So I guess I supported the Putin KGB.
Supporting the war in the Ukraine.
Yeah, man. Support the execution. All the war crimes on the Ukrainians. I think my Slade collection came from Russia as well. So, because they have.
That raises an interesting topic or an interesting point. If all these things are available, I know there's stuff out there because I was on a site that has a lot of lossless music, etc. Going, wow, all these albums are out on CD. I had no idea. So I went on to Discogs and checked it up. And the only release is one that says this release has been blocked from sale. The only ones that are blocked from sale over on there are Russian counterfeits. So my question is, why are these albums not on CD yet?
To combat the
piracy out there.
It's hard to say. I have no idea.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean,
I think there is such a lack of interest in back catalogs from younger generations. They just don't care. They just download a tune on their phone if they want to hear it or go to YouTube. That it's kind of like the Gen Xers and the boomers that are still buying these. And, you know, we're not getting any younger. And we're dying off. So there's just not this great, like, I would think a Slade box set or a Suzy Quattro box set would be a natural, but I realize, oh my gosh. It's like, well, the people who love Suzy Quattro in the early 70s are in their 70s. So it's just like, it's probably just seen as a doomed market unless you can somehow get a comeback for or reignite interest in her music, which would have to be, a song would have to be featured in a Quentin Tarantino movie or some equal blockbuster to get people interested again, or a TV show. That seems to be what drives the sales of everything now. Is like, is it in a movie? Oh, okay, there's a new interest in the Beach Boys, you know, whatever.
Like after the Lethal Weapon 2, wasn't it, with the Beach Boys suddenly got with Kokomo?
Maybe. That sounds about right. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
But getting back to, and Suzy Quattro, the only concert I ever walked out of because I was just absolutely bored.
It was, she's probably too old to be on stage, I'm sure. You know?
Oh, that was 1999, 2000. So yeah, it was 20 years ago. She was only about maybe early 50s, my age.
Well, the time to see her would have been the 70s when she had the the hand-picked band, included Duke Mitchell's son of all people, and the Chapman Chin produced albums were, you know, the regular thing and everything. That would have been the time to see her. She would have been amazing then.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But get back to the soundtracks. I mean, there's no reason why, obviously besides money, where a company couldn't say, right, we're going to take the Code of Silence soundtrack and we're going to make a run of it on CDs, of 1,500.
Right.
And once the 1,500 are gone, that is it. We're not printing anymore. Don't ask. Not going to happen. Get in now. Get it. Because it's going to be worth something in the future. There's only 1,500 in the world. Same with Night Shift. Same with plenty of others out there, I'm sure, have gotten vinyl only releases, you know, back in the day, and nothing else after it. Yeah, it only seems to be the ones like Goodfellas with all the songs there that's going to sell, and ones like, what ones have we got? Ghostbusters,
Heavy Metal.
Yeah, that's another one that would sell because of all the, you know, the songs on there.
I would say that soundtrack is probably more popular than the movie was.
What's that Cheap Trick song on there? Reach Out?
Reach Out, which is not on any of their records.
Holy shit.
It's like their best tune, and it's not on their records.
Yeah. But a bit better than Up the Creek, the song they did for that. I mean, yeah. They hate it. Rick Nielsen said, don't even ask to play it. It's not happening. They hate it.
Yeah. But
yeah, I mean, that's a thing that could be done. Which company takes it on? If they take it on at all, I don't know. I've often thought especially lately, geez, I'd like to start a label up and just re-release albums that are hard to find. The one that I would do first would be the Dizzy Gillespie, Lalo Schifrin Free Ride album from 77.
Yeah, would love to see that.
That is such a damn good freaking album.
It's fantastic.
You know, it's gotten a vinyl only release, and it got a CD release in 93 from a German company, and that is it after that. This thing should be readily available for most of the time, but it's just gone.
Jazz albums from the 70s, especially when they got into the kind of jazz rock thing, they're super scarce. They get these limited print runs. They're only, the CD only comes out in Bolivia or someplace like that. You know, it's crazy. It's really whack.
That is an absolute gold mine of an album. It's 8 tracks and it is 8 or 9 tracks. It's an absolute blinder from start to finish.
Well, what I can be excited for is, I think in a few years, those jazz albums will be public domain in Europe, which means we'll get these cheap box sets from Europe of all those jazz records. Right now, if you go to any CD store that's well stocked, you go in the jazz section, you'll find there's all these box sets of 60s Blue Note jazz that are public domain bootleg releases, but it's a great deal. For $7, you can get all these J.J. Johnson records, or, Kenny Burrell, or what have I got over there? I got Kenny Drew. I got a Kenny Drew box set I've never even opened because I was just buying them in stacks and everything. And Wes Montgomery, you just get them and they don't cost anything. And the transfers sound pretty good overall. It's very rare that you get bad sounding public domain transfer of these records. You want to get the super remastered Rudy Van Gelder remastered Blue Notes, have fun spending twice as much buying one album, but here you get like 6 or 7 albums in one box set. It's a good deal, especially if you like jazz. Yeah. And you can acquire a lot of it at once and, you know, kind of do your own personal jazz radio station programming for yourself, you know.
Well, I got a Glenn Miller box set I bought many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. Sorry, no, not a Glenn Miller box. It's got Glenn Miller on there and a bunch of other jazz.
So it's like big band jazz from the
40s. Yeah. And I think it was about a tenner for 8 or 9 albums, LPs in there.
Yeah.
And I popped it on over the weekend. I thought, oh, this is really cool.
Yeah.
Oh, everyone can enjoy this a lot.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
That's the thing I would like to have done was have just a small label with a 1500 run of these albums and just grab like local bands here who have released EPs and stuff. Because I was talking to my brother, and I said, they get put out. See, someone must own these tapes, these master tapes. Where the hell are they? Someone must friggin' own them.
They're usually in vaults at studios. And sometimes, I guess, with the songwriting companies that might have a vault holding them. Like, I remember Buck Owens, the country singer, was unique in the 60s because he kept his masters. He didn't let the record company keep the masters. He kept them. And back then they didn't care. Like, well, why you want to keep the masters or whatever? It's like, but he was a smart businessman, you know, pretty ruthless, I think, in some ways. So throughout the 90s, you got these great remastered series of Buck Owens records from his personal studio master. So there you go.
Wonder if the Return of Bruno's gotten a CD release ever.
Yeah. Bruce is sitting on it, but of course, I guess we should address the Bruce Willis in the room, that he is retired, announced this week, retired from acting, because as reported on this show probably a year ago, I can't remember what episode, Bruce is suffering from a form of dementia that is basically, they bring him to the set, he reads cue cards, he's sitting down the whole time. There's an action scene you think you're seeing Bruce in, it's actually a double. Stunt double. He, that's why he's been able to be in like 50 or 60 movies in the past couple of years, and all straight to Redbox. It sounds really bad because it sounds like elder abuse or exploitation.
It's exploitive.
Yeah, it's really tacky. And these are, of course, they're non-union shoots. These are indie productions. They don't have to follow the rules. They don't have to clear it with insurance to have Bruce Willis in their movie. They probably film him for 2 or 3 days and that's it. And, or maybe even a day. And it's very, you know, kind of Roger Corman, you know, tackiness to it. Or it's kind of like, it's like what Eric Roberts does, except Eric Roberts is fully in control of himself. And
yeah, of course. Yeah.
but it's
also the thing as well, where, and I've been guilty of it, making fun of the Bruce Willis posters over the years where he looks the same. I thought, Bruce is just staring at the camera like this. Well, it's not much of a poster, but then again, the guy wasn't very well. So they should have really done something different, at least. You know, a good poster, if you don't want to go to the extent of something like the Animal House or a Rock and Roll High School, those big, elaborate drawing posters.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore. They don't want to.
No. A poster that really caught my eye, was Goodfellas, which was just the three guys in the front, Leotta, De Niro, Pesci. But the other one that really caught my eye, it only had the two main leads on it, was another De Niro film, Midnight Run.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, you know what? It's nothing spectacular at all, but it's just enough for me to go, I want to see this film. Whereas the Bruce Willis ones, it was just seemed like this.
Yeah, he's doing the horse face.
Bruce, try and smile.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll do.
Or he does the smirk. He's staying to the side doing the smirk or whatever, the Bruno smirk.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's about it. But getting back to Hudson Hawk as well. Look, I didn't hate this film. Can't say I was impressed by it a great deal. Just the jokes, John, they just fell so...
They're very up. 90s. They're very right before Nirvana hits it big. They're very, it's that weird era of pop culture that's kind of forgotten. There's this like weird 89 to 91 gap where that type of humor was the in thing to do. This kind of dark, mean-spirited, National Lampoon kind of humor.
Can we talk about who else was horrible in this film? Was Andy McDowell.
Yeah, she's not good. I don't get the hype on her. Never have.
I don't think I've ever really liked her a great deal. Any film, like, the only one the film I really liked, which I've always shouted about, was Green Card, that she did with Gerard Depardieu the year before, 1990, I believe. Right. That was a fun movie. I really liked that one quite a bit. But most of her other films just doesn't work for me. I like Gina Davis more.
Yeah.
Around that period. Yeah.
Well, she was always cursed because when she was picked to play Jane in Greystoke, Glenn Close dubbed her voice. And that really hurt her career. And she had to make that comeback in Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which of course brings back the, hey, let's mainstream indie talent, you know, because Sex, Lies, and Videotape was a big indie film. Mm. And that was a huge hit on that circuit. And so I think bringing Andy McDowell into this movie was kind of like, hey, let's bring more of this indie talent into our mainstream big budget film. Yeah. And, maybe it wasn't the best decision. Maybe they should have gone a little more Hollywood, a little more mainstream studio for some of their picks here. But, you know, as is, it doesn't derail the film for me, but they could have picked a better leading lady, I think.
I agree. It's just the dialogue was awful.
Well, she can't deliver jokes to save her life. So,
no.
Very poor actress.
The dialogue overall was just terrible. The one that stuck out for me amongst the many was the one when they were in the Sotheby's, I guess, auction house. type of thing, and they're you know, bidding on that wood, that wooden horse, whatever it was,
right, the Da Vinci horse or whatever.
Da Vinci, yeah, that's it. Now, number one, the guy who brought the horse out just brought it out. I'm sorry, if you've seen those things, they carry them out with white gloves, yeah, always,
yeah. Right.
Right. Number two, nobody goes up and just inspects the horse or the item, mm-hmm, and gives a thumb. No way, not happening.
Yeah.
You're there, you bid or you don't bid. You know?
Right.
Not a case, oh, I want to go up and inspect this. No. So, yes, as petty and as picky as that may seem, it just niggled away at me. I just thought, it's not... You know, it's not authentic. It's not real. In this film called Hudson Hawk, where they, Bruce Willis goes through a body thing and lands straight into a chair and hands the horse over to Frank.
Yeah, they did a editing continuity jump, kind of like a comic book or something. That I think that was intentional and how
that was
so weird. And I think I've seen that done in like Matt Helm movies, like the Dean Martin Matt Helm movies. So, you know, I'm going to go back and do a watch of those and see if there's an editing trick like that. But it was kind of like a continuity gag, like the turning the page of a comic book. That's all that was.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to take it too seriously, but I will point out the funny thing that this movie always reminds me is of an America where getting a cappuccino was actually a big, rare, exotic thing.
Was it? Okay. So yes. That explains that joke.
We did not, back in 1991, we did not have coffee shops across America. You rarely saw coffee shops were very rare outside of big cities. And getting something like an espresso or a cappuccino was super rare. Believe it or not.
That's all I've ever seen in Australia is jars coffee. They always had them.
Right. Always. And in America, back then, if you went to the grocery store, there might be four brands of coffee, and there was no organic whole bean coffee or anything like that. I didn't start seeing those until like the mid-90s. But coffee was bought in a can or a bag. And so this idea of him, all he wants is a cappuccino, is actually, that shows you that this was pre-Starbucks. So coffee shops were not everywhere, maybe even in New York. Where you could just get a cappuccino when you felt like it. Yeah, so that's a funny thing that movie always reminds me of, that like it was a different America, no Starbucks.
Yeah, see, Australia's always had a coffee culture. Mm-hmm. It's very, very big. I mean, God, we got them here in where I live. It's just everywhere. They are everywhere.
Yeah, it was more of a European thing, I think. And
oh, of course, yeah.
And you guys got an extension of that. Like I noticed the French influence on the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese love their coffee products. If you go to an Asian grocery store, you go to the coffee aisle, it's all Vietnamese imported coffee, and they have
the craziest
selection of different coffee drinks.
Yeah.
They love their instant restaurant cappuccinos, and it's nuts. And they got coffee with ginseng in it and everything. It's crazy. And I always enjoy going to, we have a local Asian market or grocery store, a big one called the Viet Hoa. And I go in there and I just go through the Vietnamese coffee section and just go crazy and just, oh, I'll try this, I'll try that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Asian stores, you got plenty of those as well in my area.
Yeah.
Yeah, very multicultural. Asian stores, Indian stores. Oh, God, Indian restaurants, you can throw a brick and hit six of them. There's that. I mean, you go down a particular street, not far, probably about 20 minutes from here.
Right.
The street is literally like Little India.
Yeah,
the whole sort of areas like Little India. I mean, you go into sort of Ligon Street. You got then Little Italy. That's very famous. You got Chinatown. So there's you got the Greek sector over towards the northern end of the CBD. So it's a lot. Northern end or the western end. I can't remember one another. My geography is terrible. But so there's so many little sectors in Melbourne.
Right.
So there's no shortage of things that you could possibly want. So getting back to what you're saying, you know, seeing things like, you know, the coffee culture with Ligon Street, with the Italians and the Greeks, and just grow up with a Greek coffee in the house. It was just, amongst my grandparents.
It shows you how kind of bland the American culture was when it came to coffee. Like we weren't big on it. And then something happened in the 90s or later in the 90s where suddenly Starbucks became a staple everywhere.
Well, for instance, how many Indian restaurants do you have near you?
near me, I've probably got 3 or 4.
And what sort of circumference?
I'd say, okay, like there's one a mile down the road, there's one 3 miles down the road in a strip mall, there's one over at a more nicer upscale place next to a PF Chang's, so it's a little fancy, you know, more mainstream Indian restaurant. But they are around, but it's not like we don't have like an Indian neighborhood where you can have a bunch of restaurants or anything like that.
Yeah, that little India area I was talking about a moment ago has 14 restaurants.
Jeez.
On the street, or 15 on the one street. So that's just, and then there's all the ones from my house to there and in between. It is, there's a lot. So
wow,
if someone loves Indian food like myself, hey,
I love it too. So yeah,
well there you go,
you got it made.
Oh dude, we got, and then you got all the Indian restaurant, the grocery stores. There's 1, 2, 3 in about a 1 mile radius. So 1 mile that way, another one that way.
Right.
There's all this talk. I want to be in Duluth tonight. I go to work.
Right.
Yeah, but anyway, get back to Hudson Hawk. Look, for me, there really wasn't a great deal in there, and I'm sorry to the people who are watching or listening and going, oh, you guys don't talk about Hudson Hawk. I can't talk about something I just did not enjoy. So, I don't know, John, you got anything else you want to bring up about it?
Nothing else I can recall, because we don't have Hunter here to talk about the Catholic controversies of it. So,
we can find, maybe you can do Godfather 3. We can do that.
Yeah.
There's plenty of Catholic stuff in there.
Right. I just remember like one of the lines that really fell flat that, you know, Bruce thought was cool as hell was the, after the butler character gets decapitated, he's like, I guess you will be attending that hat convention in July.
Oh, yeah.
And you just know that he thought that was the coolest line ever.
They're the jokes I'm talking about. Where
yeah.
They just, you know, even for me back in 91, I didn't catch this in theaters. I caught it on VHS as a new release. Mm-hmm. And thought, So...
wasn't quite the Carry On Thief movie you wanted it to be, right?
No, it was not.
Carry on, cat burglar.
Carry On Thief. Well, there's one they missed, the Carry On crew. I'm sure.
Yeah, do like a heist film with those guys. Would have been pretty funny.
Spying would be about the closest they probably did.
I thought that one fell flat for me. So.
Yeah, that was that early wave of carry-ons that we spoke about when we did Carry On Cowboy. They just hadn't quite hit their stride,
right?
Until Carry On Cowboy, no pun intended, where they just clicked into gear and everything after that was basically just funny as hell.
Right.
Excuse me. So, but, you know, I watched this again. The wife has it actually on 3 DVD sets that she picked up. She's big into those, you know, 5 films of Steven Seagal.
Right.
She's got a few of those. And then there was a 3 films, one she had of Bruce Willis that I was looking at on the shelf the other day. I said, oh, didn't even know she had this. It was, Hudson Hawk, Striking Distance, and Blind Date were the 3 films on there. I thought, when you brought up, or whoever brought up the Bruce Willis, and you want to do, what was it? What was the one we're going to do? Bruce Willis?
Sunset, I think is what we were considering.
Yeah, I thought, don't even know it. I thought, what about if we do Hudson Hawk? It's banned all this, some sort of, you know, conversation about the,
right,
how much of a massive flop it was back in the day. And honestly, I can see why. It was just, yeah, people had seen Die Hard. They'd seen Die Hard 2 was out the year earlier, and this one in 91, and yeah, as you said, they wanted Die Hard 3 basically, and they didn't get it.
But it should have been promoted as Moonlighting with Graphic Violence, and that might have gotten a more accurate audience in, but I don't know how you do that. Yeah, because it's basically like a Crosby and Hope road picture with with stunts and action. That's really what it is. And you're not meant to take it too seriously. It's funny because I realized this movie, it's well known that I like this film because my brother once gave it to me as a Christmas gift on DVD. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So apparently it is well known in the family that I actually dug this film. So I just remembered that. I'm like, oh yeah, my brother gave it to me 1 year for Christmas.
You still talking to your brother or not?
No, I still talk to my brother.
It was one of those, I've had enough of you, Johnny, take this piece of shit.
No. He gave it to me. It was purchased at Walmart, I'm sure. $10 bin or something back then. But yeah, although I watched it on Tubi, I didn't feel like digging it off the shelf. So I just.
Oh, really?
And I think I could have just pulled it up on Netflix, probably. Supposedly Netflix has it as well. But, you know, I just did the Tubi and ran it. You know, I was like, you know, it's fun to revisit. It's not a classic, but I enjoy it. And, I would rather watch it at Christmas than Die Hard. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, maybe because it's been forever since I've seen it. And I thought, I forgot all about Hudson Hawk, how good or bad it is. I truly had forgotten. And I watched it. And I was going, anyway.
Well, it's like a friend of mine defended Moonraker one time, and he had the perfect description. He says, it's basically looking at a 1979 Playboy magazine on the big screen.
That's true.
When you watch Moonraker. So these kind of movies that don't always hit the mark and they're uneven, but they have some highlights, there's sort of like a time capsule effect with them. And Hudson Hawk really is like a 1991 time capsule.
Oh, yeah.
Not really a year I enjoy going back and revisiting, but it does remind me of what things were actually like back then, because you're getting hit with all this nostalgia because of shows like Stranger Things, where people think like the 80s and that early part of the 90s were completely different from what they actually were. You know, and I think we always bring that up on here, but it's like, you know, I often wonder if people are overrating the 80s right now because it's getting that kind of, oh man, I wish we could go back to 1985 and all this stuff. I wonder if it's because it was pre-internet and everything moved slower. And if life moves slower,
I really think it is. I
think it was better because it was, because now things move so damn fast that, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm exhausted. I'm like, oh my God, I did a podcast and I worked 8 hours and and then I ran errands for my wife and then I went and took the kid to this. And it's just like, good Lord, you know, in 1987, if I were a dad, then life wouldn't move this fast. It just
wouldn't. Nah, absolutely not. You're totally right.
Yeah. And I think that's what people are nostalgic for, is what they're really missing is that feeling of life taking its time. And I think that's what it was. And if you were 12 years old, life took its time because you didn't have a car. You know, it's like you couldn't drive.
Yeah, and true. And also, you didn't have the cancer. This social media, that shit should be
a. You have any of that crap? It wouldn't exist because people would laugh at you trying to get them fired for something you said. No. You know, that really didn't start till the 90s. Yeah.
Oh, after that, I'd say.
The
whole cancel culture was way after the 90s.
Well, I'm talking about, like, okay, in terms of like Andrew Dice Clay, he does jokes on stage. Oh, he must really be a hateful person who's going out, you know, like he's mocking gays on the street. You know, minorities on the street, women on the street, or he's abusive to his girlfriends. And he was with one woman for years. He was actually a pretty normal guy in his private life. So, you know, people assuming what you see on stage is the real person, you know. And it's like back then comedians did a stage routine because they were playing a character on stage.
Well, that's the same. Well, let's bring it back to the Chris Rock thing from the Oscars. And yes, it's been talked to death all over the net, so we're not going to go into it too far. But the joke he made about Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yeah.
Okay, with the G.I. Jane 2 joke. You know, comedy is always, someone's always meant to be offended by a joke in comedy.
Yeah.
It's always meant to offend somebody. It's how it's done. It's how it's written, how it's presented as the joke. Like Jackie Martling, for instance, all he does is tell jokes.
Yeah, it's shtick.
Shtick. He does it at the expense of Jews and Polacks and gay people. But they're jokes. You can't be this fractured to be upset. People make jokes about Australians. Fucking go ahead. I actively encourage them. If you're going to make jokes about Australians, be original and do it. I want to hear them. I want to be the first person to hear them.
Yeah, just be funny.
Be funny about it. Don't say, if you're going to throw kangaroos in the joke, it's not funny. If you're going to throw Mad Max 2 in the joke, it's not going to be funny. It's shit that you are going back to the well with because that's all you know. But if you're going to do something honestly funny or convicts, it's not funny. Be creative, be original. I'll hear it. I'll probably laugh about it as well.
Yeah.
Actually, the best person who does that is Garrow. he knows how to get into the Australian culture and make jokes about it. And fuck, you've seen me. It cracks me up.
Right.
As offensive as it is. But it just, because I'm not that fragile where I go, I need a safe space to run to.
Yeah. I always felt it's I don't even know if it's big in Australia, but I always feel like it's an American thing. Where everybody's being real thin skinned and acting like children.
It's filtered through here. It really has filtered through.
Really? That's sad to hear.
Yeah. And that's a lot of, sort of complaints that Australian people have. The majority of Australians go, stop being so fucking fragile. It's a joke.
Yeah.
It's the Gen Zs. It's the Gen Zs.
Yeah.
You've only got to watch a video I saw on, YouTube, the channel Iber and Preach. They had one where they were talking about transgender. And I had and this is why I wish Hannah was on. I had a guy called Texan guy running for the Senate there or something like that called Younger. Jerry Younger or John Younger or something like that. Do you know the name?
I'm not recalling the name, but
Yeah. Anyway, he was talking to a bunch of students in Texas, mind you. I think it was Texas. And they were just going, but they were losing their minds about pronouns. I thought, okay, you've got a cause. I understand. You've got something you're passionate about, but you're literally losing your minds.
Well, they want something. It's almost like they want instant respect for no effort.
Yeah, that's exactly what the Auburn preacher was saying. They want respect, but they're not showing any respect. And engaging in a fruitful conversation. Yes, you can disagree. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Doesn't mean that you have to. And this younger guy was being spat on, called every name. It was the lowest form of human behavior I'd seen. I thought, my God, if this is the way that Gen Z's gone, fucking God help the next generation.
Yeah, it's
I really think it's a fringe. It's a fringe of amount there. So it's not, I'm not putting a blanket all over Gen saying you're all doomed. You're all doomed. Not doing that. But I am saying this because I'm not ripping into these people. I say it because I am generally worried about these people who are gonna be. When they get into the big world out there, once they're out of college, out of university, whatever you want to call it, and they go into the real world, we're going to go into some blue collar place who's not going to give a flying fuck about your feelings at all. How are they going to handle it?
I don't think they
can. Screaming, they'll get fucking knocked out. Yeah. I don't want that at all.
Yeah, it's almost like what I hope it is just a fringe. It's getting a loud bullhorn because of social media and the media itself. Our own hyper media environment is too much as it is, where non-stories become stories in no time. And then I've seen it's nonstop, but luckily it looks like people are actually tuning out of the media, especially in America. If you look at the numbers, ratings for news programs, it's not very high. Like they've just lost viewers, they've bled viewers like crazy, and they should. They're lied to all the time by these companies, and I'm throwing Fox in there too. I'm not to say it. Oh, it's all just the liberals.
Fox have gone down the shitter as
well. It's like they're all pretty horrible, and people are going to the alternative media. They're going to YouTube. They're going to Rumble. They're going to, I guess, whatever another one I think is that I heard about is Odyssey. That's one. Rumble's pretty good. But that's where all these guys like Sticks, Hacks, and Hammer and some of these goofballs I listen to sometimes have gone. And you get it's not like you're getting like a super genius telling you stuff if you're listening to Russell Brand, but you're getting a pretty decent filter to get the gist of what's going on without having to go through all these biased media stories and then having to make up your own mind. Because who's got the time to sit there and watch like 2-3 hours of news every day? I need my news in 15 minutes and I'm off, you know?
Yeah.
It didn't take me that long to read the newspaper every day back in the 80s and 90s. It's like I could read a newspaper in 20 minutes and I was good.
We had the newspaper at work. One of the guys gets it through the day and leaves on the bench. And the newspaper used to go from 100 and something pages down to about 50.
Ours are thinner than that. Our local paper, the Denver Post, is just reprinting New York Times stories.
Jeez,
it's like they barely have any local reporters these days. It's crazy. But
I'm surprised. Actually, honestly, and again, something else I don't want to see is it's a fabric of my growing up and yours as well. The death of the newspaper. How much longer can they possibly survive before they go? I know subscription online is a big thing for them. That's where a lot of their money comes from. Is the online subs, and you get the paper delivered to your tablet or your computer or whatever. But the printed broadsheet,
we lost something when we quit reading Blondie and Peanuts and Garfield every day. If we didn't get our fill, those guys and Robot Man and Get Fuzzy,
Phantom,
if you were lucky enough to get the Phantom in your American newspaper. I never did, but it's like we lost something when we didn't follow the comic strips anymore. Part of culture's gone. And boy.
Yeah, that's a good point. I used to read a newspaper back in 84. So I was, in first year of high school. And I always be looking at the Foot Rot Flats comic strip in there. Phantom was in there.
Yeah.
And there was also a cartoonist named Jeff Hook who would do a satirical drawing every day, and it was always most likely political. But the thing was with Jeff Hook's drawings, he always drew a little hook somewhere. You had to find the hook.
That's a good gimmick.
yeah And then they had guys like Larry Pickering, and they censored him until he fucking carked it and died. And boy, didn't they dance in his grave. Social media, Jesus Christ, I tell you what, if it went tomorrow and you woke up to the news and said, all social media is now being got, I'd be dancing.
Yeah.
Dancing in the street, I tell you. I just think it's... People can say, oh, get off the fucking social media. You know what? I'm only on Facebook for the group. That is it.
If it wasn't for the show, I don't think I would clock into Facebook maybe twice a month at best just to check on relatives and friends, they're up to, and that's it.
When I got a warning last week about a joke which was so benign, as in terms of what they class as hate speech, which was, it wasn't even that. But I said, you know what, fuck you guys, I'm honestly just out of here. Twitter I don't bother with, even with Elon Musk now going on the board of directors and him and his free speech. Be interesting to see what happens with Twitter.
Yeah.
But to me, to run back there, no, thank you. No. I ditched that shit back in the 2016, and that was it. Bye-bye.
I've locked my account because I got tired I got tired of the attack bots pick up on any word you use and come after you. And they don't know who you are. They don't listen to the show, so I don't really care. So, and I've got probably all the followers I'm going to get. And every day, I'm almost like, there's like 4 or 5 guys I interact with. They're all like podcast guys like us, you know, Sean Zubox or Low Res or, you know, those guys or Hans. And that's about it. And I'm just kind of like, I think all the people that I follow and they follow me, I think a lot of them are shadow banned, and they actually shadow ban them for locked accounts like mine. So, cause I'm seeing the same 5 tweets over and over again every time I log in all day, and I'm like, what are they doing? Are they shadow banning everybody? Like, nobody's talking. It's like they're making me have to go to people's pages to look up the tweets and stuff. It's strange. Like, I just noticed that in the last couple of weeks. It just doesn't seem to refresh very well. Like, I'm seeing tweets from the morning and the evening, you know. It's bizarre. They're doing a lot of wonky stuff, and I know they're in a panic this week, which I'm glad. Elon's announcement, he's not like a Moses to me or anything, but But his announcement, boy, you could see the quake in a lot of boots when he after he made that tweet. And it was actually, it was a relief to hear. I was actually glad to hear that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It could only be good. It's not bad. So let's see what happens.
Yeah, I'll be watching from a distance to see what goes on. But I'll tell you what, now Twitter is black marked for me. Just no way.
It's Discord, pretty useless.
I enjoy Discord as well. I mean,
yeah.
But you know, let's wait and see the future of that, how that goes.
Yeah, we do have a Discord group, by the way.
We do. Yes.
If you're a fan of the show and you want to interact with us, just and whip out, you can whip out your junk on the Discord.
Yes, you can. You
and impress us with your shopping purchases.
Yeah, whip out your junk section. We've got Ask the MMC. We've got the movies, politics, music, general. It's all there. You basically feel free to join. The link will be down below in the comments in the info section. And let's rate
Hudson Hawk. Okay. You want me to go first?
Yeah.
All right. I give it a 7.5.
Okay. That's pretty damn high.
It's high, but it's probably what I would give your average Roger Moore James Bond movie, you know.
Mm. See, I gave it a 3.
That's high for you though, Stu. That's high for you. That's high for you in an American movie. So there.
No. I don't hate American movies. You know that. Because one of my favorites is Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. Made that well known over the last 12 years of the MMC, how much I love that film, and years before that as a kid.
Right.
But, and Can't Stop the Music and many others as well I enjoy. They Call Me Bruce, Wacko.
Grease 2, is that in the list there?
No, not even Grease 1. I'm not a much of a fan of that.
You gonna sing Let's Bowl Tonight from Grease 2?
No.
Rockahula Luau, you know, throw those every year in Melbourne.
No. Elvis movies, down there, American. I love my Elvis movies. So there's plenty of American ones out there I like. But yeah, that's just a 3 from me. And before we go, must mention Rue Britannia's back. Ned's finally got his
guys' equipment ready, he's
got his system up and running, and got the latest one from him. It's the Venomous Anthony as usual, so it's pretty cool. And that'll be at the end after this. We'll have the return of Nez finally to the MMC.
Massive cool.
So very cool. Very happy that Anthony's back and finally got system. He kicked Putin's ass and told him to get the fuck out of here. He's trying to hijack my computer. That shit to do. Watching Jess Franco movies. Can you believe Nez has now gone through? Last time I spoke to him the other day, he had 5 Jess Franco films to go out of, and he's seen them all. Everyone.
Seen them all?
All.
Wow.
What did he tell me? It was 181 or 191 Jess Franco. He's seen them all, bar the last 5 he's got to get to, which by now, I'd imagine he's seen, because that was about 4 days ago. Last 3 days ago, I spoke to Anthony last.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of days, something like that. Maybe but pretty close to the end.
That is like Vincent Gallo telling me that he and Johnny Ramone, this is back when Johnny was around, he and Johnny Ramone had a competition to see who could watch more Euro trash horror films. And he said Johnny would win because he'd watch all those Jesus Franco movies. And he says he'd watch all these Jess Franco movies, and they're all terrible. They're terrible movies. And he says I can't beat him because I can't watch those things. So
who was it who said that Johnny Ramone? I think it was him, had a massive VHS collection. Was that you who said that?
It's
well known.
Vincent Gallo told me, but it's also very well known.
Yeah, massive VHS.
A gigantic collection. I think he talked about it in interviews. He was watching like 2 or 3 movies a day in retirement. You know, he's like, oh yeah, I watched some movies, then I watched Mystery Science Theater 3000, and you know, like that's all he was doing, was just watching B movies all the time on VHS.
Oh man.
It's like, it's strange, just like, you know, other people take up skydiving, golfing. Johnny was watching, you know, the brain from Planet Aris or something, you know, or the teenagers from Mars or whatever the hell.
Amazing colossal man.
Yeah. Wasp woman, you know, he's just watching them. He's probably just running them all the time because it's probably what he watched when he was a kid. It's probably what he went to see in theaters and everything and in Queens.
Joey was out, you know, he's Che Guevara fist in the air. Johnny was sitting up watching the movies.
Yeah. Joey's playing in glitter bands as Jeff Starship. He was. All he was right. A drummer in bands, and he was called Jeff Starship, and he dressed like Gary Glitter or something.
Oh, boy, he's a bad choice of role model in the end, I guess. All right. All right, mate, let's wrap it up, and we'll hear from Anthony. And anything you want to plug?
Nothing to plug this week.
Nothing to plug?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not yet.
All right, well, we're going to wind up and say catch you later.
All right, peace out.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the Nez.
In a move that will surprise no one, even those who think that Jada Pinkett Smith is the pin-up girl for the blind, a Tory MP, male, shocked Westminster this week by coming out of the closet as a transgender. Robert Layton, Tory MP for Purgatory, was unrepentant as he flew out of the closet this week and danced the life fandango. Quote unquote. "Why, I've always been a purveyor of the dark-handed path," he, she, it said in a press conference outside a female bathroom. "I can't wait for my constituency party to get a load of me in my new party frock. To bargain for Marks and Spencer for £50 off the peg," he, she, it boasted. No truth, however, to the rumour that he, she, it is changing his, her, its name to Lolly Badcock. Comedy. And following the success of this year's WBO Super Featherweight title fight, involving Will BLM Smith versus Chris BLM Rock, the Academy of Motion Picture Sciences denied claims last week that the BLM slugfest tarnished the ceremony's image. "Why, it's simply wrong to assume otherwise," said President David Rubin. "Indeed, for next year, we're considering asking Anne Hathaway to sing nominated songs whilst throwing bars of melted gold into the audience as a memorial gesture of racial reconciliation," he pledged. Though at the same time, he also denied rumours that the cast of Dune Part 2 will be in attendance at next year's ceremony, merely so they could hang around at the bar at halftime playing poker with tarot cards with the all-black cast remake of Jaws. Paul Garrow. Sport, and the race to buy Chelsea Football Club from Russian oligarch and money launderer Roman Abramovich stepped up a pace this week when the shortlist of potential buyers was announced. They range from the owner of the Boston Celtics, to the owners of the Chicago Cubs, to the owners of the LA Dodgers, to a London real estate agent and an actual Chelsea fan. He presumably therefore has absolutely no fucking chance of actually buying the club. Still, makes a pleasant change from the usual array of Arab head choppers, terrorist backers, rags and Russian gangsters who ended up buying English football clubs. Speaking of rags, the draw was made last week for the first round groups for the World Cup this year in Qatar. England ended up in Group B with Iran, the US and the Ukraine. To deal with any potential hostage scenario, both the SAS and Navy SEALs have been placed on standby. After all, you can't be too careful, can you? Further notes in passing, the government announced plans to send more missile systems to the Ukraine. I guess it makes a pleasant change from the idea of the Labour Party shipping them to Hamas. Black activist Shaul Amos called for reparations for the black immigrant community. "I myself have donated 1p to the reparations fund. I hate to think that they were money motivated. Don't spend it all at once." And the government's campaign to rehouse 300,000 Ukrainian refugees runs into difficulty when only 1,500 people signed up to rehouse them. "I myself have applied for my own Ukrainian 18-year-old au pair. I've even prepared a basement and a radiator in advance." I hope she's game. And finally, Boris Johnson had a quiet week this week, leaving aside his sister boasting on a radio station that Russia had won the war in the Ukraine. His staff is being awarded fines by the Metropolitan Police over illegal parties during the pandemic, and his father defending the Chinese Communist Party yet again. Leaving these aside, it can actually be said, frankly, that Shirley has for once had a rather quiet week. Not to worry, I'm sure he'll get back to normal and fuck it all up again next week. For after all, he is a...
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.